The XX Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, September 5th. The Marshmallow Test Edition. I'm Hannah Rosen. I'm in the D.C. studio, and I am joined in New York by June Thomas, Slate's culture critic and editor of the Outward blog. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And also Noreen Malone of The New Republic. Hi, Noreen.
Hello.
Before we get started, I want to announce that we are having a live show right near Washington, D.C. The show is sponsored by the George Mason Center for the Study of Gender and Conflict. It's on Wednesday, September 18th. It's going to be held on the Arlington campus of the university. So please, everyone in the D.C. area, buy your tickets. You can buy them from the Slate homepage. We would love to see you there. It's going to be me, Noreen, and Dan Coy. Sorry, June. Yeah. You're excluded. They wanted a man. Can you believe it? They asked me specifically because they have, you know, military people around. Can we have a man come? So I submitted. Typical patriarchy. Exactly. Anyway, I submitted. Okay, our three topics for today. First, are American schools failing nonconformist kids? Do they put too much emphasis on self-control and give not enough breathing room for the unruly wild child? Second, is online dating making us more politically polarized because we want to date people who are just like us, and that is bad for America? And third, what is happening to poor white women? It has been recently discovered that they have a higher mortality rate than their mothers did, which is slightly shocking in an industrialized rich country like ours. And so we explore what on earth is going on. Let's start with American schools. Does everyone remember that famous marshmallow test where a group of little kids in California in the 60s are seated at a table in front of a marshmallow? I've watched these videos, by the way, over and over again. If nobody has, they're incredibly funny how the kids in front of the marshmallow try and bide their time. They are told that if they wait and don't eat the marshmallow, they might get another one. And then the researchers tell us that the ability to resist the temptation to eat the marshmallow, to be disciplined and focused and keep your eye on the long-term prize, namely two marshmallows, is a predictor of long-term success. Well, that idea, which we had kept in our minds for the last 40 years, it turns out it might be ruining American education. We have come to a point where we value what's known as social emotional regulation, meaning the ability to sit still and control yourself above everything else. And that emphasis, argues Elizabeth Weil in a New Republic cover story, is squelching creativity and nonconformism. There are so many things I loved about this story. For one thing, it went a long way towards explaining why boys have such a hard time in school, something I write about in my book but never quite figured out. I hadn't quite grappled with the cult of social emotional regulation. But Noreen, since you are more recently in elementary school than June and I are, since you just graduated from elementary
right.
school.
Just a baby. Just a baby.
Since you're just a baby. Do you remember things like OT and emotional regulation? Like, I certainly don't, but I'm trying to decide when that became part of our world, the idea that discipline was important and good.
I do not remember occupational therapy as it is described in this piece. That could be because I was like a pretty well-behaved kid in school, but I really don't think it was around in the same way. And in the piece, Weil says that in the literature in 1981, there was a single reference to this thing compared to, you know, however many thousands last year. So it's something that's, you know, come up, I think, since I graduated from elementary school, very, very recently, obviously. But maybe you guys can help explain to me something that I found confusing in the piece, which is that on the one hand, she describes her child not being disciplined by her teachers. The teacher asks her, you know, like she asks her daughter to perform this emotional self-regulation. On the other hand, she talks about how schools are incredibly data-driven and they don't sort of leave room for kids to be individuals. And I'm just a little unclear on how those two things are reconciled.
Well, the most interesting thing to me about her essay, which I had never thought of, I have very often thought about the glut of OT. I remember very vividly being a new parent and a friend of mine who had a little kid. You know, she was told that her daughter was leaning. That was like a big thing when my first kid was little. So they would be sitting in circle time in preschool, and her daughter was leaning on other kids, right? So it was like she was bugging them, right? Mm-hmm. And instead of, you know, telling her, get the hell up, girl, or like, you know, pinching her or putting her in the corner or saying, stop leaning. They had a very grave conversation with the parents and said, I think you need to take her to an OT and find out what's going on with her. And my friend was actually incensed, much as Elizabeth Wheel was, and said, absolutely not. You know, we're not taking her to any evaluation. And it turns out this isn't a problem at all with her daughter, who's now a teenager. But what I hadn't put together was the connection between lack of punishment and this. So I think the connector there is that she says schools won't punish kids, right? That they won't just discipline them and tell them to sit up and do their thing and behave, and that's part of the problem, is that instead they pathologize. She writes, we realized we had crossed some weird Foucauldian threshold into a world which authority figures pathologize children instead of punishing them. So pathologizing becomes the only way we can think of individuating kids. It's something like that. It's like, on the one hand, we have the strict world of testing, which requires you to sort of sit still, do your work, you know, the world moves very fast, and then individuation means like giving you your own special diagnosis.
It also feels like it's saying to the parents that this isn't, they're not saying this isn't our job. They just seem to be indicating that they're not able to perhaps achieve that goal. And so they're essentially, or as Ms. Wheel sees it, putting it onto the parents, which, you know, again, it's just feels like it's whole part of this. You know, if your parents are engaged, if your parents know what's going on, what they need to do, then you've got such a huge advantage over if your parents are just like, what? Which I just feel like my parents would have been, you want me to watch? He's leaning.
Right.
Get over it. Come on.
And, yeah. And Wheel mentions the threat of lawsuits, you know, the sort of overly engaged / overly litigious parents who say, you know, if you make my daughter do this, you know, or even the kid who says, my parents will sue you.
She did cite one case, but that felt like one of those things where, you know, people say, well, you might get sued. And, that never quite rings true, like whether people really believe that or it's just something they say.
Right. So the two things that emerged for me, the lawsuit is something concrete, so we focus on that. But one is a sense of schools that are afraid of parents, like they're afraid to discipline and kind of own their authority, which, again, is something that we talk about all the time. And second, that struck me as very odd, is the way parents, she doesn't say this because she's a resistor, like her daughter's a wild child and she kind of resisted the schools. But I think with most parents, the way in which we kind of welcome this mild pathologizing, because it's not extreme pathologizing, but the way in which we are comfortable around the language of OT and sensory and social emotional regulation. I mean, I count myself among this. I was just telling Mike, our other radio producer, that my son takes the social emotional regulation class in the school that he goes to. And I was making fun of him yesterday, or we were joking about it mutually. And like, but we kind of, this language is just part of the soup we live in as parents, you know? We just kind of accept that this is, you know, okay. It's in fact, we weirdly accept that it's one thing that makes kids special in a weird way. Like, no one wants an average kid. I remember in Nathan Heller's wonderful review of Far From the Tree, the Andrew Solomon book, he had a riff about this, which was very interesting, which was about how, like, we all want our kids to be special in a certain way, and that's part of the allure, weird as that seems, even if that special comes by way of a diagnosis.
And we all want our kids, I mean, you want kids to be self-regulated, right? Like, that is the goal. It's just the way that you get them there that is up for debate, right? Like, you to be an effective adult in the world, you need to be self-disciplined. And the old ways, like, it's just giving someone a new template, right? Like, the old way is just you slap your hand until you learn what not to do. And this is like, you know, building your core muscles from inside. Like, literally your core muscles so you sit up straight is apparently a thing that they have kids do, as I sit up straighter in the studio. But also, like, just like your personal ability to concentrate.
But it's the pathologizing really struck me, because when I was researching my book and thinking about what was the difference between boys and girls in school and what had changed, right? It's not like in one generation of boys have become more rowdy. I mean, maybe they play more video games, so there is some evidence that, like, they have shorter attention spans, but surely we all have shorter attention spans, right? Like, the cartoons move faster. Everything that everybody does moves a little faster, so everybody has a shorter attention span. There are actual studies done where they have been lying lining up kids like since the 70s, and they show, you know, the ability of children to stand still has decreased rapidly over the last 40 years. So like the amount, they measure the amount of time kids can stand still in a line before fidgeting, and obviously that's decreased a lot.
Sorry, but I can't concentrate on a thing you're saying. I'm just picking up the walls here. Stop talking.
But you're a girl, Noreen. This is my point here. My point here is like this must be the fact that our heads are full of the social emotional regulation language must be the reason why boys seem bad to us, naughty. Like that you look in a school and like I talk about this idea that girls have become the gold standard for behavior. And I don't think it's that the behavior of boys and girls relative to each other has changed that much. I think it's the way we see that behavior that's changed. And so we suddenly are pathologizing things that we used to just think of as in the normal range.
See, I guess I see it slightly differently, though. To me, and I don't know the author of this piece, and I'm sure she's a fine person and has a great daughter. But I also have a slight feeling that maybe there's a kind of an excusing possibility going on with some of this. I mean, some kids are kind of naughty. Some kids are disruptive. I speak as somebody who was a disruptive kid, unfortunately. That, you know, it's all very well to say, oh, he's just different. He's just not, you know, meeting the goals that are set down now. And while that might be true, that's also not necessarily different from saying he's a bit naughty or she's a bit naughty or disruptive. And, you know, one of the things that strikes me these days is that society is changing, that in the past there were more options, not only as far as behavior goes, but also as far as outcomes go. Right now, it kind of feels like, despite what people like Peter Thiel might say, you need to go to college. As difficult as it's getting, if you don't have money in your family, if you don't go to college, the outcomes are so much worse. There aren't the other possibilities that there used to be. There aren't those manufacturing jobs. There just aren't alternatives that used to exist. And so it's so much more important that people comport themselves in such a way that they can get to college, go to college, stick through college, graduate through college. And, you know, maybe it didn't matter so much in the past, but it matters so much more now. So I don't think that's why schools have changed the things that matter, but it kind of, you know, slides right into that whole thing, too.
So I am just begun to read Amanda Ripley's book that's gotten a lot of attention, The Smartest Kid in the World, in which she compares different school systems. And you realize that the things you think are important, like discipline, standardized testing is absolutely important. Like every country has their own version of that, which makes kids more or less miserable, right? Like we all want to be Finland, which seems to have a much more kind of humane approach to this. You know, Korea, South Korea, for example, has a tremendous amount of success, but is, you know, squelching nonconformity to the absolute extreme. You know, it's all testing and weeding, you know, starting in kindergarten. So I guess it's just a question of, you know, which direction do you want to send kids? June, I'm curious how you were ill-behaved and disruptive. What did you actually do?
I was just fidgety and talkative. And I, you know, then at a certain point, I just like didn't go to school. So I just kind of I wasn't a bad child. And I was a little smart-mouthed. I mean, that was another thing that it didn't quite ring true to me when the author said, oh, I never thought of discipline. Geez, man, when I was at school, a big reason I didn't want to become a teacher was I went to a school for softies. I mean, there were no really bad kids in my school at all. And yet we still tortured teachers. And if kids like the ones who I went to school with were torturing teachers, I know that real kids would be. And so it seems kind of crazy to think that, oh, I never thought about discipline. I mean, are American kids so well behaved in school that they never act up?
No, definitely not.
I mean, that just seems weird. Of course, discipline is a huge thing. In like, that's kind of the hardest part of teaching, it seems to me. Am I crazy in thinking that?
No,
I think it's just the question of, you know, what are the tools you have available to discipline kids? You know, if you feel like the only tool you have is to, you know, talk about the underlying problems and tell you what the kids' issues are. I mean, I don't know. I'm torn about this because I have a kid who would be always in trouble if the world were not slightly more humane. You know, he'd always be like locked up in the principal's office. So I'm happy that the world views these things slightly more gently, you know, so that I don't kill him. But yes, I understand that. The last thing I want to say about this is because our own Allison Benedict, who is not with us, I mean, she's alive, but she's just not with us. She wrote this piece, which pissed everyone off so much, about how you're a bad person if you send your kids to private school. And I secretly agree with her, but don't tell anyone that. So she wrote this piece. And I will say that out of this piece about social emotional regulation, I got a lot of emails from friends, especially new parents, saying, oh, God, this is terrible. I'm going to send my kids to private school. You know, that this whole idea of sort of, you know, squelching the wild child. It's and it occurs to me what they don't understand, which I do understand because I'm 12 years into the process. Private schools are even worse. Like the idea that, you know, you go to public school and it's all conformity. And then the private school's line, they're sort of publicity brochures are always, you know, we recognize the individual nature of your child. And, you know, your child is very special. It just feeds into this whole dynamic that she's describing. You know, we will like pathologize your child as much as you want. You can pay us to do it. And so I just want to put that out there in case any of you listen to this segment and decide at the end of it that you're going to send your children to private school as a result of it.
I have to say, I loved Allison's piece because I think it is a really weird thing that doesn't get acknowledged much in this country that, you know, all of this focus, I mean, of course, it's easy for me to say this as a non-parent, but all of this focus on, you know, doing whatever you can to help your child succeed. I mean, at the extreme, it's the tiger mother phenomenon, means that, you know, if the tiger mother gets her kid into Harvard, someone else's kid doesn't get into Harvard. And so it's all about, you know, prioritizing the individual and your personal priority over, you know, the whole of society. And I mean, I guess that's the American way. So it doesn't surprise me, but it's kind of weird that it's so accepted. I mean, it really is the underpinning of American society, but it's odd.
Isn't it?
You know, it's so funny that you notice it's odd because what nobody noticed. I really am with Allison, and now you're going to tap into my righteousness, so I have to control myself so this second part of the segment doesn't go on forever. But like, it. What's amazing to me is all the responses to Allison's piece were, you know, does she really expect you to you know, a child only gets to go to school for 12 years. Does she really expect you to sacrifice your child, right, you know, in order for the sake of future children? Yeah. I mean, you know, yes, it's like, why is that such a big deal? Because I mean, I'm a total righteous public school person, so.
Right, because if you're not sacrificing your child, you're essentially saying, so I'm sacrificing those other kids. Like, it's one or the other, so maybe you could at least live your values and put your kid through it, too.
Okay, but what about
and
people
what does
who...
sacrifice mean?
Exactly.
What?
Okay,
right?
Time out. Guys, come on. I'm a proud public school product, but, you know, my parents moved to a place where there are good public schools. What about that? There are always going to be people sort of, I'm not saying that's gaming the system, but that's a factor when people, you know, think about where they're going to live. It's, you know, when you look at a really good public school versus a private school, it's really not that different in many ways.
Right. That is the first few times that people very proudly told me they went to public school, and then later realized, like, well, because their parents moved to X district and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, I mean, at least they're going to public school. At least they're taking part in the system. It's better.
Yeah, and the difference is, Noreen, the difference is in the expectation of attention and response that you'll get. I think that's the critical difference, is that I have one kid who has always been in private school, except for a couple of disastrous years, and my other kids go to public school. So I really am not allowed to be this self-righteous. But what I noticed in the years I was with him in private school is the essential difference is not necessarily the quality of education. It's the expectation of parents of particular attention, like that your child's particular needs and status will be recognized. Like, not necessarily that your child is special, even if your child is mediocre, just that the system will recognize specifically and tailor themselves to the needs of your child, right, which is how private schools advertise themselves, and which public schools just don't do that. Even great public schools, it's just not a line that they put out there. It's not what they're about. So I think it's, you know, which kind of system do you want to lock yourself into? I'm going to stop because our listeners are going to – you should complain vociferously, all you listeners who send your kids to private school. It's fine. We can take a whole other round of complaints on Allison's idea.
Bring it.
And we'll read the best one. Bring it, and we'll read the best one next time we podcast. Okay, let's move on to our second topic, is online dating making us more politically polarized. But before we do that, our loyal sponsor, Audible.com, which offers over 100,000 audiobooks as well as almost any form of enlightened chatter available on the internet – and you can listen to them on practically any device, including the one you're using to listen to us right now. For XX listeners who are not Audible members, you're offering a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX, not XX, but XX. This summer, we drove back and forth to Vermont, which is a really, 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 really long drive. And I would say the drive was largely made bearable and pleasant, even thanks to Audible. We were listening to the Rick Reardon Lightning Thief series, which my son is really into, and really kept everybody not wild child. It kept their social emotional regulation deeply in check. But the one that I want to recommend, actually, since we're talking about wild children and nonconformism, it's a kid's book, and it's called The Mysterious Benedict Society, and it is, in fact, available on Audible, and it's a wonderful book about very nonconformist kids and the special things that can happen to them. Okay, let's move on to our second topic. Is online dating making you more politically polarized? We have heard a lot of different reasons why our country is politically polarized. The rise of niche media, the rise of interest groups, the lack of civility, the fact that politicians don't spend any time together anymore in Washington and are always going home. Now from the Pacific Standard, we hear about a new reason, which is online dating. Now, when we scan for a date, we learn much more information about the person we want to go out with than we would ever before. And people generally don't tend to choose opposites. They choose people just like them. And that means ultimately people who share our politics. The result, says the story, is a political process more combative and gridlocked than ever before. The piece brings together two sciences, and then maybe they're dubious sciences, the science of how we make political choices and the science of how we choose our mates. The first thing that I found surprising, and June, maybe you'll find this surprising too, is a third of all marriages begin online, and about half of those met through an online dating service, which is kind of extraordinary. June, when you were meeting your mate...
Thank God it was before the days of...
Did your relationship begin online?
It did not. Actually, it began at Microsoft, but in the actual building thereof, so on campus, as they say, but not in the
So in an online atmosphere.
So like high-tech, old-fashioned.
Exactly, old-fashioned high-tech. But this doesn't surprise me at all. It seems that I'm not in any way wishing to not be in a relationship, but I almost am a little sad that I mated pre-online dating because it seems like everybody's doing it and I feel a little left out. And it doesn't surprise me at all because it's an extremely efficient way of meeting people. And, you know, what is the internet about except emphasizing efficiency? And so, of course, that's how people are going to meet. What I don't quite buy in the study is the kind of connection between these two things, the two things being the growth of online dating and the increased polarization of politics. I mean, yes, people are now meeting online, but they're also still going out into the world. They're not never leaving their apartments and only doing online dating. They're also still going to work and going to church and going to softball games and going to all the things, all the traditional ways of meeting people. And, you know, they're probably still working in that building at Microsoft. But to me, like the conclusion doesn't match the setup. The two things may indeed be true, that a lot of people are meeting mates online and politics are increasingly polarized, and that's not a good thing. But what are you going to do about it? Should people not date online because of that? It just feels like two separate things that aren't necessarily causative of each other.
Yeah, and my colleague Nora Kaplan Bricker wrote a little response to this on the New Republic today, where she picked it apart, and she pointed out that the study on which the article is premised doesn't actually compare couples who met online to couples who met traditionally. It's just there's sort of no sample to study to look at it against. And also, according to another 2011 study, only 14% of online daters even included political interests in their profile, and you know, which is really not a significant amount. Right. And then 57% of those people then said that their politics were, quote, middle of the road. So the people who are choosing, you know, who won't date Republicans or won't date Democrats are people who probably in real life would have those same preferences.
Right.
I think that you're doing too literal-minded a reading of this study. Like, they don't actually say that it's, you know, you scan for Democrat. Like, how unromantic is that? The point is that you're choosing on a political profile, like you're engineering a mate in such a way that, you know, you can pick up hints, like what music somebody likes and what, you know, whether they recycle a lot or not, or like where they take their vacations, such that you are increasing the phenomenon in America, which is already out of control, of like meets like. I mean, this is like a tremendous engine of social inequality, is the way that dating and marriage happens now, whether we want to admit it or not. Like, it's not just that it takes the romance out of dating, whatever. You know, lots of things take the romance out of dating these days.
Dating.
Dating takes the romance out of dating. But this idea that, you know, you are always seeking out your own, and it's increasingly easier to do that. And dating sites are just like another way to do that. So, you know, in the Mad Men era, just to take the most crude example, Don Draper marries the secretary. Like, there are ways in which money would get passed around. So we wouldn't be consolidating social classes. You would not be marrying your really hotshot business school classmate. You would marry the secretary. And in fact, it didn't, you know, lots of men and women married across social class, across political boundaries. And now that just happens so much less frequently. I don't think it's entirely the fault of online dating, but I think it's really interesting to think of online dating as the most obvious place where that can happen very efficiently.
Oh,
you know,
Hannah,
if like somebody's like,
you're madly trying to fit your personal agenda into this study. Yes, of course, online dating cuts off the possibilities of serendipity. You are saying that you want this. You're saying what you're looking for, and therefore you are not seeing what you're not looking for. Yes, I'll accept that. However, there's so much else going on. I was listening recently to the Savage Love podcast, which everybody should listen to because it is crazy. And they talked, a woman called Dan Savage because she'd been using an online dating service for X years and she hadn't had many dates. They called up this guy who's very high up in OkCupid. And basically his view was that she just wasn't hot enough, because the biggest thing in online dating is the hot pictures. That's what people are picking on. They're picking on pictures. And, you know, as somebody who would not be picked for their picture, you know, my hope is always
not
like,
true.
Well, we'll just let that go. But like, you know, I think, oh man, this would be great because, you know, it would be all on your writing style. It wouldn't be, because it's all about the pictures. And it's all about, as the guy from OkCupid said, if you're a six, don't be going for tens. You know, like, it's all about that. I do not think that politics come into this at all. I agree with you, Hannah, that there are certain coded methods of saying not necessarily your politics, but your kind of your social niche. But it's not about politics.
Okay, guys, I have online dated.
Let's listen to the online dater here.
I actually did not enjoy online dating. But it's, people do just, it's so easy to just click away from someone if they have one word that you don't like. And that word could be Republican. It could be like, I don't know, state school. It could be all kinds of things. Actually, a lot of people now are gravitating towards sites that really try to replicate offline groups more. So something like OkCupid, it's just everyone in your city is kind of in there en masse. Now there's something called Date My School, I think, that someone was telling me about. And I think the idea is that it like matches you up with people who went to your school or like an equivalent kind of school. And then there's another app called Tinder where you can see like if you have Facebook friends in common with this person. So Hannah is right to a certain degree that it is allowing people to self-select in ways that people have been doing offline for years. You know, like you might ask your friends to set you up with someone in real life. And this is, I guess, showing the Facebook friends you have in common with them is sort of an equivalent.
Yeah. And I guess, too, that sites like Christian Mingle or JDate or other, you know, that they're intentionally set aside or try to set aside, you know, like these will be people who with whom you share this already when you, I mean, clearly that's
right.
Part of this effort.
Those are the sites for people who like want to get married. There are other sites that are like for sex. Christian Mingle is not for sex.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've never been on Christian Mingle, but I'm assuming.
It's for everything but sex. It's for just going to second base. So I just wanted two last things on this. One is that I don't blame online dating sites, but they're just kind of pushing forward something that society's doing anyway, just so I get in the last word here. And then my final last word is that I was just thinking when I was reading this story who I dated. And like the first person I dated was, you know, he was the son of an evangelical preacher and pretty conservative. And then I dated this very conservative Israeli hottie guy at some point. There's just no way. Like, if I was scanning either of their profiles, no way. Like, just right. No way would I have stopped on their profiles for 1 second.
Right. So. It ruins the opposites attract kind of possibility.
Yeah.
Right. Because you're just sitting and making fun of them. Right.
which is a really fun part about online dating. I will say that is like hanging out with your friends and just like going through people's online dating profiles.
Oh my God.
Yes.
The world is a terrifying place.
Divorced friends. All right, let's move on to our third topic, which is not as funny. What is killing poor white women? For most demographics, life expectancy is rising in the U.S. and has always been rising, but not for poor white women all of a sudden. They've lately lost 5 years of their lifespan from previous generations, which the author in a new story calls an unheard of drop for a wealthy country. This story was in the American Prospect, by the way. I have to say I felt guilty reading this story because in my End of Men book, and the Rise of Women, sort of my whole thesis, I kind of portrayed these white women as on the make. You know, not necessarily the poor white women who are described in the story, but apparently all these things that they're doing to you know, keep themselves on the make, that is taking care of kids, you know, trying to go to school, hustling, is ultimately killing them. This story was really sad, I thought. I mean, she followed one particular person and sort of, you know, went through her life, and it just got increasingly depressing with, like, everybody on disability and nobody able to hold a job. Although she did have some really, really interesting theses about what it is that's going on with these women. Was it education? Was it class? So, June, do you see this as purely a class thing? The poorer you are, the harder your life is?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think also where you live, you know, definitely what kind of education you were able to get, who you marry, if you marry. But essentially, it comes down to class. And I thought it was a fantastic story. I thought Monica Potts did an amazing job of really describing, especially this woman, Crystal's life. And although it is a bit depressing, I also felt that she did an amazing job of expressing, you know, the richness in a sense of her life. Yes, she died young, and yes, she did not have a job, and she lived for many years on $1,000 a month, which was her husband's disability pay, and she didn't have health insurance, and she, you know, didn't travel, but she had a rich family life until her family started to die off, also very young, that is to say her siblings. It's, I think, one of those kind of pieces that when people read it, all of the sort of the knee-jerk things that people say of, well, you know, people need to make their own, blah, blah, you know, they need to pull themselves up. How exactly in that place, it's Cave City, Arkansas, what else could she have done? She, you know, although Monica Potts doesn't actually, you know, she kind of insinuates that perhaps she wasn't tremendously intellectually gifted, and that it was a struggle to school was a struggle, and she dropped out when she got married in the 10th grade. But all of the things that in this country where there isn't you know, shared systems like healthcare, she just didn't have any of the support that helps people succeed, and there weren't any jobs that she could be doing, and the kind of jobs that she could be doing, maybe not where she lived, but somewhere else, like childcare, like elder care, don't pay well enough to do anything different from what she was already able to do.
So the best part of the story for me was how she runs through possible explanations. I thought she came up with some really, really interesting ones, the author. She runs through the marshmallow test one. I mean, the first thing we talked about on this podcast, you know, this idea that the best guess is that staying in school teaches people to delay gratification. But she kind of dismisses that one, which is interesting. It was interesting to me, having read the thing about social-emotional regulation, that that's the first thing researchers offer her up, because obviously that's just kind of a trendy idea now, right? It proves the thing we were talking about. talking about in the first place, that the first thing people turn to, oh, is if she had just learned to delay gratification, you know, and stay in school. And in fact, in her case, I think she was quite a good student early on. And then she just kind of drifted away and lost her focus. And it turned out she couldn't really keep up. So, you know, it wouldn't have been such a great toddler prediction of her success. But the most interesting one, I thought, was the one about the economy. This idea that, because I don't think people think of women in this way exactly, that having a job mattered for lots and lots of reasons. Now we're back to the Clintonian welfare to work argument, but that having a job provided you with a social network, financial stability. And she says smoking and employment were the only two factors of any significance, which I don't think people think of women in that way exactly, as employment being their means to kind of being in the world and having a satisfying life.
Yeah, she said sense of purpose, but also the community that work provides you. And that gets us to one of what I thought was one of the really interesting parts, too, is the difference between uneducated white women who are dying more earlier than uneducated black women.
Right.
And she couldn't quite, you know, get to a full conclusion on that because there's just, you know, the data doesn't explain it all. But one, you know, one thought was that, you know, maybe just black women, uneducated black women tend to be concentrated in cities and maybe just have a clearer sense of community or have a clearer community there. And I thought that was really interesting. And then the other possibility is that even though both those groups of women, you know, tend to have diabetes and weight trouble, which is, I think, partly what ended up killing her, poor white women do things like meth more frequently, and that's a quick killer, unlike, you know, obesity, which is a slow killer.
There was also a suggestion which, you know, felt a little bit vague, that in a sense, no matter if things are bad for them right now, there's a feeling that black women's lives are still better than the lives of their parents or grandparents, whereas poor white women are seeing fewer and fewer possibilities, that it seems that even though it's my anecdotal feeling that many, many people right now are feeling that their lives will be less successful in certain ways than their parents, you know, that they're not going to do better than their parents. For poor white women, they're definitely doing worse than the people that came before them, and that's kind of depressing.
And she has a-
that was this was. The racial comparison was my absolute favorite part of the story. I thought this was so smart. As someone who's written about the transition among, you know, working class white women and how they've more and more often become breadwinners, this comparison she made about how for black women it's been going on slightly longer and they have an ownership over it. You know, they have more, she writes, perhaps they have more control relative to the men in the communities, whereas in the low-income white communities of the South, the women do everything, but they don't necessarily get the credit for it. It's not quite socially acceptable to, you know, call yourself the breadwinner of the family or be explicit about the fact that you are earning the money. And I portrayed this when I was reporting in Alabama. I thought of this as a plus, like they're dealing with the situation graciously. You know, they have this awkward situation where the men are suddenly not working and they are, and they're not rubbing it in the men's faces. But it never occurred to me that there was a psychological toll for this, because if you are, in fact, working really hard, taking care of the kid, earning the most money in your family, and as she writes, but they can't take credit for being the breadwinner, that's a cost, because you don't get to have that social acknowledgement or pride of being the breadwinner. It all becomes a source of kind of shame, awkwardness, and tension in your family. And I really, really never thought about that.
She had a great line. She wrote, "Women do the emotional work for their families while men reap the most benefits from marriage. The rural South is a place that often wants to remain unchanged from the 1950s and 1960s, and its women are now dying as if they lived in that era, too."
Well, and also the fact that, she, you know, Crystal, it sounds like, was looking after her husband. I mean, that was her job. Her husband was on disability. He was 12 years older than her, but it sounds like around the time that he was 30, after an accident in a chicken plant, he, you know, his health was very much damaged, and she was taking care of him. But that's not a job that paid money. And it's just not clear to me, as convincing as I find this, you know, sense of purpose argument, what job could Crystal have done? I mean, what we know is that low-wage work, it tends to be the kind of work that is not very rewarding in any sense of that word. You work endless hours for very little money that takes you away. And it's not doesn't tend to be the kind of jobs like we have where you can, you know, sit and talk to people. You are on a line or you're taking care of people and going around. It's just it's not a communal kind of working environment. And so I just don't quite know what this work that would have given her this sense of community would have been. She wasn't an isolated person. And I don't know, I wish I liked the sound of that, but I just can't see in Crystal's life what job could she have gotten where she lives that would have given her that sense of purpose.
I don't know, just had to have a reason to like leave your house in the morning, I think is good to you know, joke with people at lunch or whatever. I mean, I think there are small ways that all jobs. I'm someone who likes work, so I'm not the right person to be talking to about this. But you know, she it said in the piece that she called her family at 6 or 7 every morning. She was someone who wanted to get out of bed and do something.
Sure,
and she wasn't necessarily.
Yeah, and but there weren't jobs. I mean, it doesn't sound like she was turning away from a job or choosing not to work so that she could look after like. There was a plant some distance away, which would have cost money to get to, probably would have paid essentially nothing. When she had one daughter, how, you know, like poor people can't afford daycare. What would she have done with her daughter? It's like the practical challenges. I even just reading this piece overwhelmed me. It's, you know, this again, this country is not very kind to people who need help.
Well, on that depressing note, let's move on to our recommendations. I think I'll go first this week because mine is slightly relevant to the topic we just discussed. I'm going to recommend this Planet Money show. I think it ran on Planet Money, and it also ran on a couple of other radio outlets called Unfit for Work, The Startling Rise of Disability, earlier this year by Hannah Jaffe Walt. It's an unbelievable long hour which explains why everybody in America is on disability. It's kind of a missing piece of the puzzle of the story that we just discussed, and it's really, really fabulous. The second thing I want to recommend is this book, The Flamethrowers by Rachel Kushner, which we are actually talking about on a Slate Audio Book Club this week, but which is I just had to reread it to do the audio book club, and I just think it's absolutely fantastic, like the best novel I've read in a long, long, long time. So I recommend you all read it. Noreen, you want to go next?
I have been listening to the new album from the Julie Ruin called Run Fast, and the Julie Ruin is the latest project of Kathleen Hanna, who was Bikini Kill and La Tigre. And sort of an icon of the 90s. And even though I'm sick of the current fetishization of Riot Girl culture and music, it's just an awesome album, and you should all listen to it immediately. So I'm fetishizing it, I guess.
And June?
I would love to recommend something which is coming to a close soon, sadly. The Guardian, which, as you know, a few years ago came to America, recently also went to Australia and started an Australian edition of The Guardian. And as we also know, there's a election campaign going on in Australia. And so in addition to the British Politics Weekly podcast, for the course of the Australian election, they've been doing an Australian Politics Weekly podcast covering the election hustings and so on. And the amazing thing about it is kind of how familiar the politics are and the cases. But then at the same time, there are things that are totally different and not only limited to the vocabulary, but recently they talked about the leader of, well, currently the leader of the opposition, who will almost certainly win the election, being seen as a daggy old netball dad. And I mean, you just wouldn't get that description in America.
What?
A daggy old netball dad.
Okay, after the show, I want you to teach me how to say that.
And they also, speaks dry, Noreen, speaks dry. And they also call each other cobber, which I thought they only did in books. And the other thing about it that's really been amazing is that most of the guests and all of the key people are women. The political leadership of The Guardian Australia are all women. And it's just a really fascinating podcast. And I think the next episode, which will kind of wrap up the election results from this weekend, will be the last in this particular series. But I hope that they do more podcasts about Australian politics because I am totally into it.
So I'm going to Australia. I've never been to Australia.
Oh, but
yes,
God.
I was invited to this Dangerous Ideas Festival, it's called. And I think Dan Savage is going too. And I at first, like, I was like, there's no way in this whole planet I can ever go to Australia. And then I'm not going to be there very long. And it's like a 20-hour flight. So it's right. All slight madness. But I decided, okay, when am I ever going to get the other opportunity? So I'm going to Australia. So I'll listen to the podcast.
Envious.
Anyway, okay, so I will remind you all to buy tickets, anyone in our area, to buy tickets to our live show, which is on September 18th, to all Jews and friends of Jews listening. Happy Rosh Hashanah, Happy New Year. I also want to thank Lori McHugh for doing our research for this podcast, to Chris Wade for producing and engineering this podcast, and to all of you for listening. And we will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Bye.
Bye.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.